Hello and welcome to this session on mitigating catastrophic biorisks with Professor Kevin Esvelt. Following a 15-minute talk by Professor Esvelt, we'll move on to a live Q&A session where he will respond to your questions. You can submit questions in your name or anonymously using the box to the right-hand side of this video. You can also vote for your favourite questions to push them higher up the queue. We'll try to get through as many as we can. Then, after 20 minutes of questions, or about 22, I'll bring the Q&A to an end. But that's not the end of the session. To help you think through and apply the ideas you've heard, I'll be asking you to join a 20-minute icebreaker session, where you'll have two speed meetings with other attendees to discuss your thoughts on the content. I'll explain how to do that when we get there. But now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for this session. Professor Kevin Esvelt leads the Sculpting Evolution Group at MIT. He helped pioneer the development of CRISPR genome editing and is best known for his invention of CRISPR-based gene drive systems, which can be used to edit the genomes of wild species. He has led efforts to ensure that all research in the field is open and community guided, whilst calling for caution regarding autonomous biological agents that could be misused. Professor Esvelt's laboratory broadly focuses on mitigating catastrophic biological risks by developing countermeasures, changing scientific norms to favour early stage peer review, and applying cryptography to secure DNA synthesis without spreading information hazards. So here's Professor Kevin Esvelt.
To those of us who seek to prevent the catastrophic misuse of biotechnology, the tragedy of COVID-19 has completely changed the landscape. All of a sudden, the entire world is keenly aware of our profound vulnerability to pandemic agents. That does have an upside, because after a catastrophe, we always overreact. That means our job in the near term is to ensure that that reaction is channeled as effectively as possible to prevent future biological catastrophes. A few things we should definitely have 2 years out: an advanced early warning system in which we perform metagenomic sequencing of samples taken from sewage, from waterways, and from anonymous travelers all over the world. By sequencing all the nucleic acids out there, that would establish a baseline, allowing us to detect any anomalies, anything new that's increasing in frequency, hopefully in time to do something about it. That's the highest priority. What can we do? Well, against viruses, at least, we need something that can be developed faster than a vaccine. So for example, we might take the human protein receptors used by mammalian viruses to enter our cells and make decoy versions of all of them. These could be delivered to serve as therapeutics in the event of a new pandemic agent that tries to use that receptor, or if delivered by gene therapy, could even protect us in advance, serving as the equivalent of a vaccine. If we did this for all the viruses that rely on a protein receptor, that would protect us from any agent in those viral families in advance. Finally, we need to ensure we're better coordinated next time. I would love to see the creation of an independent equivalent of the Federal Reserve, one that's narrowly focused on autonomous biological agents and has authority over other government agencies in that narrow area. Ideally, they'd also have an explicit mandate to cooperate with other nations in this regard, because we're all in this together. Now, the problem is that even though these three measures would broadly help against natural pandemic agents that are viruses or engineered agents, that's not going to be true of everything in our response. Many scientists are actively engaged in sharing methods that will accelerate the research response to COVID, for example, by making it easier to synthesize and edit variants of viruses. There are also many researchers looking at natural viruses. What are the zoonotic reservoirs? What is out there? And what exactly is it that causes a virus to jump species and spread effectively in a new one? The problem is, in biotech, our ability to engineer things is directly proportional to our understanding of how nature does it. Insofar as someone reveals what it is on a molecular level that allows a virus to jump species and spread in humans, it becomes that much easier to engineer it deliberately. Now, some people will say this is wildly implausible. We don't know how to engineer autonomous agents that can spread on their own in the wild. Well, if you happen to know otherwise, definitely don't correct them. But you can point to a safe example. 8 years ago, no one had even imagined that a single researcher would be able to build a construct that could spread to impact an entire species. Then came CRISPR. I played a minor role in developing CRISPR and shortly thereafter wondered, well, what would happen if instead of just editing the genome of an organism, we actually encoded CRISPR next to the change we wanted to make? Then CRISPR would cut the wild type version of the chromosome and copy itself and the alteration over, thereby ensuring that most of the offspring inherit the alteration and the CRISPR system. Genome editing would happen again in the reproductive cells of the next generation, thereby ensuring greater inheritance, causing this CRISPR-based gene drive system to spread through the whole population. Now, this is likely to be one of our most effective tools when it comes to challenges such as eradicating malaria. But it's also clear evidence that we can, in fact, build constructs that we believe will reliably spread to affect a species. It's safe to talk about this because CRISPR-based gene drive favors defense. It's slow, it's obvious, and it can be overwritten. That's why we thought it was safe to tell the world about the technology in the first place, and I stand by that assessment. Problem is, if this technology is safe, viruses may well be another story. And that story must go untold. We already know that historical pandemic viral agents can be constructed from scratch. In fact, they seem to be accessible to pretty much anyone with the right skills who knows the sequence of what they want to make, something that could become a pandemic, and can get the relevant DNA. And just about anyone can get the DNA because we don't actually screen all DNA synthesized everywhere in the world for hazards. Now, the real problem, of course, is that it only takes one person. That is, it's thankfully true that very few people are in the grip of a sufficiently destructive and pathological ideology or mental illness that would cause them to consider deliberately building and releasing a pandemic agent. But it only takes one. So we must reduce that risk as much as we can. That's especially true because historical pandemic agents are actually not guaranteed to take off. If someone were to make 1918 influenza today, I would actually give it only a small chance that it might actually spread to become anything approximating a new pandemic. But we need to keep in mind that evolution is not trying to harm us. An engineered agent could plausibly be worse than anything that we've seen in nature. So we must do everything we can to prevent this sort of thing from happening. I'm not saying that it is possible to do this today, by no means. Rather, we should assume that future advances will lead to technologies that enable us to build more harmful agents. Assuming when that day comes that we see it coming before any bad actor does, in principle, we could get universal DNA synthesis screening working and deny widespread access to DNA. That would be effective. However, right now, that would disclose what it is that we're screening for. And that would in turn enhance the credibility of these kinds of agents as bioweapons and actively encourage bad actors to make them. How can we avoid that? Well, we somehow need to make all DNA synthesizers unable to make potential bioweapons without disclosing what we think might make a potential bioweapon. And we need to do so in a way that's adaptive, because we don't know how to do it today, but we may learn how in the future. So as we learn, as any scientist spots a potential way of doing this, we need some way for them to enter that information in the system without telling anyone what it is. And this challenge of securing DNA synthesis without spreading info hazards is really a microcosm of the broader challenge of preventing the catastrophic misuse of biotechnology. How do we do it without disclosing what it is that we're afraid of? Well, we need to keep in mind that it's not just a technical problem. Even if we do come up with a technical solution that could prevent misuse, we also need to get it implemented in the real world. And that means we need to concern ourselves with incentives. Why don't most companies screen DNA for hazards? Well, it's expensive. Current screening methods create false positives that require human curation. That's expensive. Most companies don't do it. We would need to fix that. Similarly, there's the global challenge. Pandemics ignore borders, but DNA synthesis, for example, is done by companies throughout the world. Yet governments are presently in no position to talk to each other and join forces to deal with this shared problem. There's a lack of trust. And then there's the challenge of scientific norms. All of us, without exception, deeply resent any kind of interference in our research, especially bureaucratic interference. And many scientists believe that all knowledge is worth having, that we have a moral obligation to share everything that we find, all discoveries, genomes, and techniques, because they earnestly and truly believe that that approach will save lives. I disagree. How are we going to deal with that? Well, the Secure DNA Project is one attempt to deal with this problem, to identify and control the bottleneck limiting pretty much everyone from building autonomous biological agents, that is, access to the relevant DNA. And we've gone about it by deliberately tackling the incentives at the outset. The way it works, to avoid disclosure, actually encourages companies to use it. Here's how it works. Assume that you identify something that is problematic. You approach someone who is authorized to work with the system who's an expert. They might confer with one or two other experts to make sure they agree it's a threat. And if so, they would then enter it into the system. And they would do so not by entering the entire sequence of the thing you're worried about. Instead, they'd choose essential fragments at random, compute all the functional equivalents, and then remove anything that matches anything in GenBank, anything that would raise a false positive. These would then be hashed, that is, transformed cryptographically using this distributed multi-party oblivious transformation method. So you'd get this harmless database of hashed fragments that couldn't be interpreted without the cooperation of every server in the entire network. DNA synthesis orders would be subjected to a similar process. Fragment them and transform them using the network. Then these uninterpretable fragments can simply be directly compared. And if there's a match, the synthesizer rejects the order. Because this protects the privacy not just of the potential hazards, but also of the orders, there's an incentive for companies to work with firms that use this system because it protects their orders from potential industrial espionage. There's also an incentive for the providers to adopt it because it's fully automated. The false positive rate is going to be so low that it should not require any kind of separate human curation for more than a decade. Then there's the global aspect of the challenge. We recognize that governments were not ready to do anything with this. So we launched the project from the outset as an international collaboration involving those of us in the United States, working closely with our partners in China and in Europe, scientists and cryptographers all working together. We're similarly in discussions with industry partners throughout the world, and we're letting governments know of what we're doing, but we're not letting them become involved in any way due to those persistent issues of mistrust. Finally, there's the delicate issue of scientific norms. Here, our overwhelming priority is to avoid doing anything that would delay anyone's research at all. And in fact, we want to do it in a way such that someone working on an agent that might in future be determined to be hazardous never actually learns that it's been so designated. That's much the point. So how can we do that? Well, whenever we begin a new experiment, we're supposed to get permission from our biosafety committee to do it. If that biosafety committee then provided a certificate corresponding to a whitelist, that is, everything that we are allowed to make and work with, that could then be provided to a DNA synthesis company and allow us to make anything, even if it's on the hazards list. That would ensure that anyone who is already working on an agent wouldn't even notice that it had been added to the list. But someone who wanted to do something new and creative with something they haven't worked with before actually would need to get permission from their biosafety committee, like they're supposed to be doing already, in order to work with that kind of sequence. This effectively would nudge experimental research away from anything that might be hazardous, but it wouldn't highlight them, and it wouldn't actually deny anyone anything because they always could go ahead and get permission, assuming they could convince their biosafety committee, which usually you can. Perhaps most importantly, this provides an infohazard safe option for scientists who spot something of concern. If secure DNA is successful and you identify something of concern, instead of naively warning the world and likely precipitating the creation of that agent that you're concerned about, you could work with the system to ensure that it gets added, and consequently, synthesizers will be unable to make it unless the lab has specific permission to work with that kind of agent. I'm not saying that this is an ideal system. I'm sure there's lots of flaws and holes in it. It's not intended to be perfect. We can't stop well-resourced actors from making DNA. But we believe that this is a start that will show that good science and safety can go together. And we would very much welcome any feedback or suggestions from anyone and everyone. More broadly, this challenge of preventing the catastrophic misuse of biotechnology is almost certainly one of the most important that we will face in the next several decades. If you're interested in helping out, whether that's by working in the trenches yourself and striving to convince other scientists that we need to be cautious, changing norms from the inside, or by changing the incentives, by becoming an editor, working for a funder, or going into policy, please do. And if you'd like help in that, if you'd like experience working in a lab, please reach out to me. Thank you so much to the organizers for this opportunity and to all of you for your attention. Stay well.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that talk, Kevin. I see we've had a number of questions, so let's kick off with the first one. So very topical. Focus on biosecurity has obviously increased due to COVID, but has the pandemic actually changed any of your views?
So this is a tough one. What's changed is my estimation of how well prepared we are for a more severe event. And I'm hopefully that was going to change due to the COVID response itself. But right now I have to say that we were less well prepared than I anticipated. Mm. And I was particularly surprised by the response of WHO and especially CDC, which was extremely disappointing. On the other hand, a number of middle income countries have done extraordinarily well thus far, much, much better than anticipated. So hopefully we can glean some lessons from there and apply them more widely.
Mm. Which countries would you flag there?
So it might change, but Southeast Asia in particular has had extremely few infections, even though there is clearly a lot of exposure to the original Wuhan event in, say, Thailand and Vietnam. They have really kept it under control to an extraordinary degree. And similarly, South America is getting hit very hard right now, but Uruguay is doing exceptionally well. Now, admittedly, they're barely a high-income country, much better organized, small government is good government. Mm-hmm. In terms of smaller countries tend to have better governance, less partisanship, et cetera. But even so, they're keeping the numbers down extraordinarily well, and hopefully that will continue.
Mm. And in Southeast Asia, do you think if you had to guess, was that primarily because they've dealt with SARS and MERS previously and they were just better prepared than Europe and other countries?
That's certainly a part of it. I'd be surprised if that was all of it. Some of it might just be culture of ubiquitous mask wearing from the get-go, but that's clearly not enough to stop real super spreading events. So how have they managed to do that? And I'm not an expert in this. I haven't really looked into it, but it would be great if someone would, because possibly relevantly, the most likely next threat we will face is something like SARS-3. Not because we don't know what is going to be the next natural threat, but in terms of a potential engineered threat, unfortunately, the very existence of SARS makes it obvious that that sort of thing can be done. And the scientific community is going to study and illuminate exactly what it takes for a coronavirus to spread in humans, which is not necessarily a good thing, but it is unfortunately inevitable at this point.
Yeah. I guess talking about likelihoods, what probability would you put on a GCBR in the next 10 years, in the next century?
So it's important to benchmark this. And we don't have very many data points, of course, of COVID level events, thankfully. But if you look back in history, we're probably looking at something like 0.5% to 1% chance of something like COVID every year. So that gives you your baseline. In terms of something plausibly worse, I mean, again, it's clearly a good 5% in the next decade. A century is a very long time. So again, my concern is that bio is on the whole, perhaps not defense biased, but it's plausible that we might be able to discover technologies or apply strategies that could change that. And my hope is that we'll be able to do that sometime in the next few decades, and then that would completely change the calculus for the rest of the century. So I'd rather not give priors on the century level. That's a little bit too long, shall we say.
And I guess, do you think there's a reason that the frequency of natural pandemics will increase over time due to various factors like, say, globalization?
So I'm highly uncertain on this question of natural pandemic frequency going up or down. Obviously, the more humans there are, and the more, or more specifically, the more human wild animal contact there is, presumably the greater risk. I'm not convinced that that means that the numbers are actually going up. Many people believe that it is, but I would note that, first of all, more and more people are living in urban areas and are not coming in contact with wild animals. And number two, we've done a pretty effective job of wiping out a lot of natural habitats, which has effectively reduced the populations of a lot of the animals that do harbor zoonotic reservoirs of viruses that could conceivably species jump. So I would say the combination means we're actually at lower risk. But again, that's very high uncertainty. It could definitely go either way.
And I guess then taking bio, in the context of EA or in the context of long-termism or other cause areas, how do you think we should compare bio-risk threats against risks from things like advanced AI, global warming, nuclear security, and global conflict? And that's, I guess, with the EA hat on of how do we allocate resources if we care about preserving, safeguarding the future?
Yeah, so again, caveat here is that I'm naturally extremely biased. Everyone thinks the thing they work on is clearly the most important thing, right? So I definitely would not say that bio is the threat over the next century. Mm-hmm. That said, looking at it now, next 10 years and especially next 20 years, I'm quite concerned about bio more than I am about any of the other areas. Climate change is the sort of thing that makes everything more difficult, and some of the tail end risks are going to be concerning, but not over that time frame. And AI, I would have to defer to the experts. Nuclear security and global conflict, similarly, it's non-trivial, but I would say that bio is higher than those areas. Mm-hmm. Again, climate change can make the conflict more likely. They're all interrelated. But next 10 to 20 years, I worry most about bio, and then hopefully that risk will go down and we'll need to worry more about the others.
Yeah, and I guess it's also, when you think about allocating resources, you also have to think about like the real world and the timeliness of things and when to push things. And I guess this might be bio's moment to take a larger portion of resources in policy and funding.
With the challenge being that bio is, I would argue, more info hazard sensitive than any of the others by a long shot. I mean, the problem with nuclear is proliferation, right? Well, nuclear proliferation has nothing on potential bioproliferation. If we discover the wrong things and disseminate that knowledge, we're going to be in much worse shape in terms of the number of actors with access to things that we may or may not actually be able to defend against. So that's what concerns me, this tightrope between how can we adequately prepare without talking about it, without giving specifics, without being able to tell policymakers, here's the problem. And overall, I mentioned in the slide, I didn't talk about it in the actual talk, but on the slide I had intelligence communities might be a problem. Mm-hmm. We know from the history of espionage that governments are not very good at keeping secrets about major hazards. And consequently, we don't really want intelligence communities to find out in the event that some scientist discovers something nasty. We want to be able to deal with it while informing ideally fewer than 5 people. And so that's why I'm pretty enthused by the idea of setting up algorithmic systems because at least with an algorithm, it's not going to actually build the thing until we have to worry about AI, of course. Yeah. But that's, again, somewhat further down the line. So, and I'd be interested in hearing whether anyone is concerned about secure DNA, because you could argue that, you know, our hash-based scheme with multi-parties might be secure against humans, but maybe it's not secure against an AGI, and maybe that's a risk downstream. But again, it's a matter of, are you concentrating on mitigating risk sooner or later?
Mm. And are you seeing this being done at all or well anywhere around the world? Yeah, or like policy acting in sensible ways, conscious of info hazards?
So this is difficult because I don't actually have security clearance myself. So I'm not really in a position to say on that one. But of course, anyone who does isn't allowed to say either. So my assessment overall is that we are acting largely in ignorance of the potential technical nature of the threat. And I can't say much more than that, other than that the biosecurity community lacks relevant information on technical plausibility of a wide variety of actions. And I'm not sure how to fix that, because obviously there's major info hazards there. And so I go back and forth as to how much of a problem it is that people are focusing on things that may not be an issue while ignoring things that they're not aware will become an issue. And in general, I should point out as full disclosure, I know of perhaps one, perhaps two people who are more concerned about info hazards in bio than I am. So that's my baseline.
In the world.
In the world.
Right. And also, I realized the fatal flaw of that question when I said it. I was like, you can't, even if you could answer it. So where, talking about sort of military and intelligence community, where would one be best placed to make an impact in the biosecurity field, military and intelligence community, or sort of civilian research?
So here's where, again, I'm ignorant, and I would defer to those who have more access to the military intelligence community and know more about it. I've interacted enough with them through funding calls and discussions over certain risks that are best handled by government that it's pretty clear that academia leads in fundamental biotech capabilities. And yes, industry is best in near-term applications. When it comes to seeing what is possible and making it real, this is not like AI. Academia is well ahead. And my concern with the military intelligence side is, for now, they're not really taking it seriously, probably because they don't spend most of their time hanging out in Kendall Square, where every 10th person you meet has the technical capability to do some very worrisome things. But as soon as they do start taking it seriously, then as soon as it's treated as a credible threat, that is an incentive for others to start playing with it. So I'm actually not sure that we necessarily want it to be taken as a serious threat. So my hope is that we will not stumble on anything over the next few years that will enable it to become a credible threat. And we'll see.
Mm. So what areas do you see as the most neglected in biosecurity? And then which are you kind of most concerned about?
So this, again, comes really close to that info hazards problem. Mm. I really can't answer that question. But again, I think a problem is that a lot of the actors in the current biosecurity space they did their PhDs too long ago. They're too far from the technical cutting edge. And so they don't have a good overall picture of what's going on. And due to info hazards, that can't really be rectified. So I would merely note that we are never going to operate with a bird's eye view of the landscape. No one is going to have that. It doesn't matter who you're networking. I mean, the folks at OpenPhil working on it, with all the people that they talk to, even if they're disclosing the actual risk, even they are never going to have a truly bird's eye view. We're always going to be operating in an information deficit when it comes to bioinfo hazards. And that just means you have to adjust your priors, assuming that there may well be a lot out there that you don't know, and the situation is probably going to err on being worse than what you think, just because of the info hazard problem. I don't have a good solution for that or suggestions as to what to do. I am concerned overall with the possibility of dual use, just because it's really not on the radar of most scientists. But that also is a blessing, because most scientists, they would never even dream of the fact that it might potentially be misused. And this comes up all the time in like DARPA calls where occasionally the program manager will have to say, you know, this thing you proposed really has some downsides. And scientists are like, what? And that's when the program manager notices, which also depends on their level of technical expertise. On the flip side, if it requires that much technical expertise, then at least for now, we probably don't have to worry about its misuse because most rogue actors are not that good. I am most worried about scientists stumbling upon something and then someone well-meaning but naive attempting to warn the world openly.
Right.
Thereby spreading the info hazard, making it credible. Once you describe it publicly, if it's interesting, then journalists will write about it. We already know this. I'm not going to point to specific episodes, but anyone in the field knows what I'm talking about. And once they start writing about it, then there's an incentive for scientists to start studying it and determine whether it's real. And unfortunately, the downside of biosecurity research is there's always this temptation to point to particular risks in order to justify your existence. And unless you have some other means by which to be taken seriously, that can be a pretty strong temptation. So I'm somewhat frustrated by how the community is a little bit, in my opinion, lax with info hazards. And I think it's in part because the world doesn't really take it very seriously. And it's too early to tell whether COVID was going to change that. It's hard to have discussions about this sort of stuff via Zoom or really at all in these days.
Yeah.
So we'll see how things change on that. My hope is that it'll be a little bit more concerned with info hazards across the board, but I still expect the scientific community to go out and try to find out exactly what it is that makes a virus capable of spreading in humans. Mm. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to dissuade enough people in time. That is a generational phenomenon, though.
I guess this is one of your suggestions, to have an independent body or to have some kind of mechanism by which scientists can flag this without and know that that's an option rather than going and publishing it.
Yeah, to incentivize them to do the right thing in that regard. Mm-hmm. So even when it comes to, say, methods of stitching together things to make viruses in order to do virology more effectively, what you don't want to do is teach all the virologists how to do that, along with everybody else. You instead want to keep that knowledge in a few specialists that, in synthetic genomics, have them create centers that then will supply any custom orders from any virology lab in the world, as long as, of course, it has the relevant institutional permission and biosafety. That way you can actually accelerate the relevant research, and we're hoping the research is good, without disclosing to everyone exactly how it is that you make these kinds of agents and making that even more accessible than it is today.
Okay, so a bit of a kind of switch of topic, but I guess very top of mind for a lot of EAs who care about animal welfare. So what are your views of using biotech to alleviate wild animal suffering?
So this is sort of the secondary focus of my lab in many ways. And I think there is tremendous long-term potential. But to be very blunt, I'm not sure this is the sort of thing that needs a lot of EA advocacy for. Mm-hmm. Because the topic of using biotech to deliberately edit wild species, especially for the long term, especially for reasons that have nothing whatsoever to do with humans, is a really sensitive subject. People are very wary of even the idea of deliberately going in, tweaking animals, let alone wild animals, in the areas that they live in, when we don't understand ecosystems that well. So I think I've observed there is quite a risk of backlash, and it's caught up in the anti-GM movement out of necessity. Target malaria is dealing with this all the time. So I think it needs to be done exceptionally carefully. And what we found is that people are most supportive if it's community-led from the start. That is, the people living in the affected areas need to tell the scientists what they want done. And if it's done that way, then it's much more difficult for outsiders, especially anti-biotech activists and the like, to essentially throw a wrench in the works and gin up outrage. It's also true if it's done nonprofit, that helps a lot as well. Because if it's nonprofit and led by the relevant communities who are affected by the problem, and the communities are strongly supportive, then it's really hard to get traction and say this is a bad thing, because then it's like outsiders coming in and telling people that they don't know what's best for their own community. So, and then there's also, again, we don't understand ecosystems very well. And it's the people who live there who are going to bear the brunt of any mistakes. So it really needs to be in their hands from the get-go. So I think EAs can essentially respect that and advocate for community control and possibly help raise awareness of issues talking to the particular relevant community. But I think we need to be exceptionally cautious about how we approach it because there is a real risk of blowback.
Mm. And I think you've traveled and spoken to such communities. Like, what's the most positive experience you've had there, or what are the main lessons there?
The most heartening and heartrending thing that I've heard was after talking to a number of Maori in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and apologizing for how I had published a paper without thinking to run it by them at the revision stage, and how that could have harmed their political interests, and how I completely understand that they didn't want to work with us again after that. And they said, and a woman stood up and said, "I have never heard a scientist come and apologize to us for doing something wrong to our faces." And that meant a tremendous amount to them. But on the other hand, that's just heartrending that is the case. Or at least that was her perception of it. I'm not sure that's true of the community as a whole, but she had never seen it before. So you can gain a lot with people if you are willing to go and talk to them and explain what the options are and say, "I don't know what's best. You live here. It's your environment. It has to be your call. If you don't think this is a good idea, just tell us and we'll walk away." Mm-hmm. And people really respond positively to that. It's a bit of a contrast, of course, because that does mean you need to tell them exactly what you think is possible from the get-go, which means you can only do that in areas that are fairly free of info hazards, which is not necessarily true of all of bio. But again, if you're thinking of doing something in the environment, I should hope it's not particularly hazardous.
Right. Great. So again, switching kind of tact, what's your opinion on biohackers' role in mitigating the risks or responding to unmet clinical needs? And I guess there's the flip side of that question of how others view the biohacker community.
Yeah, so I prefer to call it community bio, which is a little bit more, I think, reflective of what it actually is. It's a community of folks working with bio who usually have some sort of ties to formal biotech in some way or another through academia, industry, but also includes a lot of people who are interested in playing with it and learning. In general, they tend to have a much better ethos with respect to caution than does academia. Now, obviously, there are a few very high-profile exceptions that tend to get all the press time, but the community as a whole is much more concerned with doing the right thing and much more aware that things could go wrong than the typical academic is, by a long shot.
That's surprising.
So I think, and right now, it's worth pointing out as well, community bio is not doing anything that worries me. They're just not playing with those kinds of agents at all, in part because a lot of the leaders have said, we're just not going to go there. That's just not an area that we need to play with because it raises too many potential hazards. That's the right attitude, and I would love it if that could rub off on academia.
Mm. Well, that was an unexpectedly positive answer to that question.
That might change in 10 years, depending on if they go back on that. But right now, very, very positive.
Yeah, great. And I think we have time for one more question. So I guess not in the spirit of, things to avoid, but if you could take away one message of things that people who really care about this should try to avoid if they're actually trying to do the right thing.
So here's the hardest one. Please do not try to come up with new GCBR level threats. Don't try to think about how it can be done. Don't try to red team it. If you can't help yourself and your mind just goes there when you hear a talk, just don't spread it around. Don't type it in your computer. Don't do a search history and what you're doing, obviously, looking up that sort of thing, unless you're extremely familiar with InfoSec, and really not even then. If you see something that you're just that concerned about, then you probably already know the folks in the EA community that you need to reach out to. Obviously, do it in a secure manner. Secure means if you're really worried about something, that means a face-to-face conversation and nothing else, and don't even allude to anything with details ever. Be cautious if you really think it's that big of a deal. And that said, the flip side is we really need to persuade more people that not all knowledge is worth having. That's the fundamental challenge, that if you talk to folks doing, for example, gain of function research, how do we make viruses more transmissible, more lethal in humans? They earnestly and truly believe that their work will net save lives. And if it stops, more people are going to die. And that's in part because they don't believe that their work will ever be misused. Many of them can't imagine that it could be misused. Their minds just don't think that way as to how to break something rather than to do good. And so they just don't conceive of the possibility. Or they might say, okay, it could be misused, but people wouldn't do that. And the third way is they think, well, but if we just understand it well enough, we'll be able to come up with a counter. It'll be okay. How's that HIV vaccine coming? It's abundantly clear that there are some things that we just can't come up with a defense in time. And that's not something that they see. And that's in part because I don't think that this is an immediate rational thing. It's that if you're in science, it's because you love understanding. And you've devoted your life to satisfying your curiosity. And so the very notion that maybe we shouldn't go there at all, possibly ever, is just completely antithetical to the very mindset that drives us to science to begin with. I honestly don't know if I would be saying any of this if it weren't for CRISPR-based gene drive and just realizing, wow, we went from not even imagining that something like this was possible to something that can spread on its own very extensively in the wild. And that's on me, morally speaking. All those moral consequences I have to see are on me. And we're lucky that it's defense biased. What if the next one isn't? But if it hadn't been for that experience, I don't think I would be where I'm at today as concerned as I am. So how do we bring people over without saying anything specific? Counterfactuals. It's not too hard to puncture the naive belief that all knowledge is worth having using any number of example counterfactual technologies. So do that. And you can always go a meta level higher. There are very few info hazards where you can't go a couple of levels of abstraction up and explain it. And most scientists are people who love abstraction. So try to persuade people, and whether that's by becoming a scientist yourself and working on the inside or by changing those incentives. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're going to have to do. That's what people respond to. But how can we get in a position where we can change the incentives? And can we do it in time? Because 10 years is not that long in science on the cycles of careers and generational change, even 20 years. So that said, any marginal increase in the share of scientists who are more cautious about these things could plausibly be nonlinear, just because you often mention to some of your colleagues and friends what you're thinking about doing. And if they're a little bit more cautious and concerned about the consequences, they might mention that and let you know that perhaps you're going in a direction that is best not explored. And they might even be able to persuade you. So if that happens enough, then I think we'll be in pretty good shape a few decades hence. If it doesn't, then we might have a major problem to deal with before then. Let's hope.
Okay, incredible. Thanks for that very powerful message to end on. That concludes our Q&A, the Q&A part of the session. Thank you so much, Professor Esfeldt, for your time. If you're listening in, don't go away just yet. Discussing new ideas with other people can be a really good way to understand them, obviously with the caveats we've just heard. So we're going to use the last 20 minutes of this session for a couple of short speed meetings with other attendees. If you check the session description below this video, you'll find a link to an icebreaker session where we're going to gather for those meetings. So please click on that link now and a new host will meet you on the other side. Thanks very much for watching, and thanks again, Professor Esfeldt.
Thank you.